Well, thank you very much indeed, Phil, for that kind introduction. And it's a pleasure to have the opportunity of speaking to you today about caring for the whole person. I should say that I usually hold staff meetings in this room. This does not feel like one. Perhaps I should also say that I pray every day that I will die during a staff meeting, so that the transition from life to death will be totally imperceptible. I was delighted, of course, to hear another dean talk earlier this morning, and how interesting it was to hear her speak of students doing examinations and things like that. And I should tell you that my thoughts were wandering at that time about some of the thoughts I had about students towards the end of term and facing examinations. And I particularly recollect when I was principal of St Andrew's College in Glasgow, which was the Catholic College for the Education of Teachers in Scotland, sitting one day at the back of a bus, and there were two students in front of me on a Monday morning, and they were rather bemoaning the fact that they had to study all weekend, and one was saying to the other, "And what exams do you have today?" And she said, "I've got literacy and oracy," as they say in Glasgow. And the other one said, "Oh, that sounds awful." She says, "What have you been doing?" "Oh, I've got RE. I've been daying the resurrection. I hope it comes up." These are the sorts of thoughts I have about students at the end of life, or whatever it is we're talking about. But it's a real pleasure to have the opportunity of saying a few words to you about ideas of caring for the whole person. And given that my background is not in health, and coming from Glasgow, where actually they're taking health very seriously in Glasgow these days. I mean, they have this program now five a month. Some of us are struggling to reach that. Most of the health issues in Glasgow, of course, result from force-feeding children fried Mars bars, deep-fried Mars bars, and it doesn't seem to be doing them that much harm. However, let's move on rapidly to something a bit more pertinent, caring for the whole person. And I suppose my reflections this morning are largely about professionalism and health and care. And the one thing I reflect on in talking about professionalism is what the purpose of professions are in contemporary society. And I was very interested to hear Baroness talk this morning about a definition of professionalism. I think the one thing one should reflect on about professionalism is that it deals with risk. Professions are always working for the betterment of people, but working with risk, which differentiates them from other people. In other words, if you're someone in the health services and you are not professional, you put people's lives at risk. If you're in the field of education and you're not ethical about what you do, you put people's lives at risk, young people's lives at risk. If you're working as a nurse and so on, and one could go through all the professions, and the one common issue is they put humanity at risk. And so when I look at contemporary functions of professions, I suppose I would say, broadly speaking, the function of the professions are to help the flourishing of humanity. And you might say, well, that doesn't take us very far. But, you know, unless you have a vision of what you're trying to do in the health services, or in social services, or in education, or in church, in the priesthood, and so on, then you are driven by someone else's agenda. And for me, the flourishing of humanity is essentially about two main things. One is, it's about personal and social well-being, including health, physical health, mental health, spiritual health, emotional health. And it's also something to do with developing the gifts and talents which are then put in the service of others. And for me, that's what the flourishing of humanity is about. And when I think of health, I think that that requires us to try to understand the human condition. And one of the great challenges for professions is to understand the human conditions with all its gifts, its talents, its greatness, with its frailty, with its fragility, and with all that makes us truly human. And I think that that's something that certainly in my work I try to work with people who are developing themselves and forming themselves as teachers, trying to understand the human condition so far as that is possible to understand it. And it's about the whole person, integrated within themselves and integrated into a community. And I'll be coming back to that concept of the Christian message being a message about the community and about the wholeness of the person. And the person, not just a happy animal. I mean, we are not just happy animals. We are not isolated here to be happy animals. We have a spiritual being. We have an emotional being. We have a sense of what it is to be human that is about a spirituality. And I think that that is such an important part of the human condition, the spiritual essence that holds us together and distinguishes us as human beings. And where do we see this humanity flourish? We see it in a variety of ways. But remember also that the Catholic Church and Christian churches generally are based on community. They are not about isolated individuals. Of course, to some extent, we are individuals, but we are also part of community. And I'll refer to that a little bit later about what the meaning of that is in terms of developing the whole person, because it's not just the person as an isolated human being, it's a person among us. You know, when you come to meetings like this, wonderful meetings of people thinking, praying, reflecting on what it is to be human, how can we strive somehow to bring people closer to God. And in that, you can almost feel, not just almost feel, you can feel the presence of God among us. And we shouldn't be slow to talk about that. Reflect on it. Reflect on it, whether we are people in religious life or whether we are lay people. But just to know that we are in community with God, and to be upfront about that and to be reflective of it. And that is about being part of a community. Of course, we live in a world, and I want to just reflect on a little bit of education here. We live in a world where not everything is right. We live in a world, I think, where every child should have the right, every person should have the right to be educated. But we live in a world where there are 800 million children who are illiterate. 800 million across the world. We live in a world where we're guided by the law and by regulation and by written rights. And to me, the social services, the health services, education, are not about conformity to legal documents or legislation and plans, but they are about the freeing of the human spirit. If I were to reflect a little bit on what I see in British society, I've got to be a little careful that I don't say English society and thereby make a difference, but in British society and indeed in the Western world, we are increasingly dominated by legislation. And, you know, sometimes I think we are reverting to Old Testament thinking. Live by the law, not by the Spirit. And of course, New Testament thinking is not about doing away with the law, but by coming to fulfill it and add to it. So I'm not against legislation, but what I'm saying is we need to find ways in which we in our society, in our professions, can bring freedom to the Spirit, bring the Spirit into what we do, not just live by legislation and by the law. This is simply a fixation with me. I used to teach geography, and I should just move on a bit. But actually what I want to do is just to take a moment to reflect on that map, which is about illiteracy in the world, and to reflect on the fact of where illiteracy takes place. Where most illiteracy is, as you can see, is in the equatorial areas, Africa, India, and those parts of the world. And to me that's quite interesting, that we have such preponderance of illiteracy in these areas. And I want to use that map just to reflect on this, the correlation between illiteracy and health. If you were to look at a map of difficulties of health in the world, you would find the same kind of distribution. And you could do that if you put up a map of measuring life expectancy. You can take that closer to home. I am aware that in Glasgow, I'll save Liverpudlians the embarrassment of this, but in Glasgow, there are parts of the East End of Glasgow, life expectancy, 47 years of age. In the East End of Glasgow, 47 years of age. West End of Glasgow, life expectancy, 83 years of age. Children don't decide where they're going to be born. It is a matter of social justice that people should be in good health and should be literate and should have these advantages in life. It is a matter of social justice. So when looking at illiteracy and health, the same sort of issues. When you look at conflict across the world, you see the same sort of distribution. When you look at child soldiers and child labour, same distribution. When you look at underdevelopment and exploitation of people, same distribution. And what that, of course, suggests is that health and education is all part of a complex of human development and opportunity. And for me, I suppose it's simply to say good health is not just a good idea, it is a matter of social justice. And I think that that is an important point to make to you in this conference, that health is vitally important for the human condition. It's not just a good idea, it's a human right. It is a right of every person, and it correlates with being educated, being fulfilled, and to be a person who is fulfilled with all their talents and all their gifts. And I think that that is something that people perhaps struggle with. And, you know, the work you do day by day is a means to the end. The end is to bring people closer to God. That's the end. It's the flourishing of humanity and bringing people closer to God, and it is a matter of social justice. And just to give you a few visual images of this, these are scenes taken in the slums of Mumbai last December, when I and a few people from this university visited the slums of Mumbai. And this is, as you will see, children in school uniform going to schools. And interestingly, they look to me very healthy, very clean, and actually they go to schools, and I'll show you some examples of that, frequently, and they are committed to it. That's the school. Schools in the slums of Mumbai, of course, are themselves slums. You can't build great edifices in the middle of the slums, so the school is in fact a slum. And this is some of the colleagues that were on that visit going into and out of the school. And that's life inside the school. Quite interesting to me, again, in terms of health, how healthy the children look, bright-eyed and so on. You may just want to note that the figure sitting there is Caroline Cox, Baroness Cox, the Chancellor of this university, who does a great deal of work in the underdeveloped countries, working with the poor and so on. And you get a sense of the school. That is a school in the slum of Mumbai. And one of the issues that they talk about is health. In fact, I could tell you a little story about that now that I reflect on it. Always dangerous to have thoughts when you're in the middle of a speech. As you will be aware, most people have no thoughts when they're in the middle of speeches. About 10 years or so ago, a colleague of mine from the Catholic University of Leuven and myself were asked to go to India to help the government of India write a five-year plan on education. And we were brought to Delhi, where we were given a briefing. They had this rather strange idea that before you wrote a five-year plan, you should know something about what you're talking about, a matter that had never occurred to me in teacher education up to that point. But we were taken to Delhi, we were given a briefing, and then we were taken to a school in the east of India, in just south of Patna, a place just outside Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha first contemplated God. Anyway, we went to a school, and if I just explain what was happening in this school. We were brought in to the school early in the morning, and the school was on a little hill, and as you looked from this little hill down, there was a big puddle, and then a little rise up and a plateau, and on the plateau there would have been about 12 or 14 cattle. In the puddle there were about six or seven men bent double transplanting rice, and then there's the school. Now interestingly, that plateau was the site of the first university in the world, the University of Nalanda, established about 3000 BC and went out of existence in about 1000 AD. And at its peak, it had about 10,000 students. Still not even excavated that site. And here we are in this environment. But the school, we're taken into the school. The school would have been about half the width of this room, I suppose, and not quite square, but you get a sense of. There were 174 children in the class, one teacher. And we are brought in and we're told, have a seat. There's no furniture. Have a seat on the floor. And we were told, make sure you don't sit on a snake. That keeps you awake for the morning, I can tell you. So here we are sitting there, and then I'm told, this teacher cannot read or write. I thought, well, there's a thing. Bit like Glasgow, really. I hope this isn't being recorded. But here we are in a setting, the teacher couldn't read or write, and that setting, that day, made me think what the purposes of education were. And it led me to believe that the purpose of education is never the curriculum. It's not what you're taught. It's something about forming the self. It's not informing people. It's forming the self. It's forming people of love, of care and compassion, who have a deep sense of hope, an appreciation of beauty and wonder, and who will serve the world by their gifts. That's what it is to be educated. Interestingly, what was the teacher teaching? She was teaching about hygiene, she was teaching about childbirth, she was teaching about the role of men in society, the role of women in the house, and the role of a citizen during a general election. That was the curriculum. Five areas. Childbirth and hygiene was half the curriculum. Very interesting to be reflecting on that in the poorest environment I suppose I've ever seen as a formal school, but very meaningful in terms of what it is to be fully human, to be someone concerned with health. Let me just move on. Well, just before moving on, one of the things I said about when I was in Mumbai, I asked the question to one of the Jesuits I was with, who's training teachers, and we are now in this faculty collecting money to help train teachers for the slums of Mumbai, working with St. Saviour's University, which is a Jesuit university in Mumbai. And I asked the question, how much does it cost to educate a child? And he said, the cost of a hamburger and a can of Coke will educate a child for a month. And it makes you think, what kind of world we live in and what kind of world there is out there too. A hamburger and a can of Coke will educate a child for a month in Mumbai. And so that's the kind of education that's going on there. And just to make the link between education and health and medicine, this was one of the this was the only advertisement I saw in the slums of Mumbai, and you'll see in the bottom right-hand corner in the white, education is power, which is what I usually talk about when I show that slide. Even in the slums of Mumbai, see, education is power. And you'll see just below it that this is run in a medical centre. So that link, again, between healthcare and education is very strong, and I could talk about Mumbai forever, and I won't. I could even talk for longer about life in Palestine and the West Bank and the problems they have in terms of health and the problems they also have with education, and I won't talk about that either. So what all this demonstrates to me, and I'll go through some of this fairly quickly because I know lunch is not too far away, that we should ensure that human flourishing requires that life is holistic and integrated. It's comprehensive. There's a totality. There's a unity about it. It's the idea of making sure that we are as one, holistic, integrated, that it's manageable and that it's worthwhile. And where any one of these is missing, human flourishing is at risk. Where it's not comprehensive, where it's not holistic, when it's fragmented, when it's not manageable, when it's thought to be not worthwhile, the human condition is impaired and is at risk. I think a worthwhile life carries with it a deep sense of hope and a lack of hopelessness. And I notice in the medical journals there is increasing interest in concepts of hopelessness and indeed measures of hopelessness. I note from a colleague and friend of mine who's the chief medical officer in Scotland, he has indices of hopelessness because he says it's the one indicator that is important in human flourishing and indeed ultimately in length of life. If you have a low level of hope, life will be short for you. So these are important issues, and they are issues that we should think about. And I think a worthwhile life brings us closer to God through the relationships that we develop. And they are the relationships we develop with each other. That sense of community and relationship seems to me to be so powerful that we ought to spend time reflecting on the centrality of relationships in our spiritual and physical well-being. Think of our own communities, the correlation between ill health and lack of social engagement, not those who don't feel included in community. And those who don't feel included in the community increasingly include the elderly in a world of home care. I think one of the things that we should reflect on really deeply is that, of course, as medical science progresses, people live longer and longer. But they are often living with chronic illnesses. They're often living with cancers. They're living with concerns and worries. And they're living on their own. And that's the way things are moving. And I think that that may be a challenge for the church and the churches. The number of people living with inner fear and with concerns for themselves, but living in isolation longer and longer. And of course, it's also an issue for architects and town planners. Where are these people living? Tops of high-rise buildings, never going out. Huge problems of what it is to be human and what are we doing about it. And I think that what we are also seeing is people are living in that condition for longer and longer, and we should not allow that to pass us and do nothing. We should not do nothing. As people say, you might not be able to do everything, but you shouldn't do nothing. Very important issue about living longer, but living longer with chronic illness. And the vulnerability and expressions of faith, it seems to me that as, particularly towards end of life, people feeling vulnerable, having concerns and anxieties, and they often feel the need for an engagement with faith, and it's faith probably of a certain type, that kind of concern for a spirituality that reflects a close relationship, needing to be loved and needing a sense of hope. Because that idea of hope is not something that is restricted to young people, not by any sense, not by any stretch of the imagination. A sense of hope exists in the human condition in everyone. And that, how we continue to work with that, I think, is something of a challenge. Health, in its widest sense, has to pay attention to personal identity, the identity we have as human beings. Who are we? And the centrality of faith in that. It has to pay attention to social mobility, the employment of people and economic sustainability, emotional and spiritual well-being. The very important idea of emotional intelligence and spiritual well-being, developing an inner peace and mental health, the importance of cultural diversity and acceptance of social harmony and social sustainability across faiths, and vitally important, creativity, growth, and the capacity for constant change. The importance of the human being constantly changing, not fixed in one place, constantly changing, reflecting on that change, keeping that going. And that is as much an issue for those that we serve as it is for the professions themselves. So all this will flourish in an environment of freedom, of health and happiness, where we are among human beings that have great aspirations, but there are global challenges. We would want to form a society that operates through love and care and compassion, with that care for beauty and wonder. And I just want to stop and reflect on that little comment. You know, it does seem to me that one of the most important things that we can do in life is to have an appreciation of beauty. Because that touches the inner self. We live in a world which is often very functional. But you have to wonder about the importance of music, the importance of landscape, the importance of art, the importance of all of these great, beautiful things of life, which you can only appreciate when you experience them. You know, there's no point in me telling you about the beauties of the west of Scotland or something like that. You have to experience it. You need those experiences. And I think that as we look at care for the vulnerable, we ought to care for them in places of beauty. It's not just a functional concern that we have. The sense of hope that I've mentioned, and serving world by their gifts, a society that will be a society of service, and you probably par excellence are that sense. And that, of course, is all to do with a sense of faith and hope and love. It's quite simple in a way, the gospel values. The gospel values have to touch our professional lives. That's not complex. And we shouldn't allow it to become too complex. One of the things that I find myself doing pretty well constantly is reading research, much of which should have a well-merited obscurity. Most of it, you want to just say it's about faith and hope and love. And we shouldn't overcomplicate it. And so in our professional work, don't overcomplicate it. Of course, people have got to do research and all of these sort of great things, and we've got to move on with our thinking, and we've got to be advancing our professional knowledge in every way we can. That also is important. But at the end of the day, it's about faith and hope and love. Of course, we live in a society, as we heard this morning, where there's a prevailing culture of accountability, where everything is measured. I was on an aircraft coming back yesterday. Tells you on the aircraft, outside air temperature, minus 52 degrees centigrade. Why did they tell you that? Is someone leaving, you know? If so, put on your hat and coat. I presume that's the sort of thing. And of course, I'm also well aware in the health profession, when a baby's born, it's not a question, what's their name, how well are they doing, what weight is it? Why isn't that a topic of conversation that goes on throughout life? You know, I met your sister in the street last week. What's she tipping the scales at now? You know, that is the kind of conversation you will have if you believe only in measured outcomes. And that's what a culture of accountability does for you. So we have to move from a culture of accountability to a culture of responsibility, as was mentioned earlier today. But I want to take it a bit further. Actually, I think we need to move to a culture of co-responsibility, where we're working together as responsible people, where the church, the professions, patients themselves, clients, pupils, students, whoever it is we're working with, whoever we serve, working with us, in a culture of co-responsibility. You cannot be held accountable or responsible for everything. But you can work in community to be co-responsible. Do your bit, but others should do their bit too. So don't take the weight of the world on your shoulders. Don't find yourself professionally weighed down by all the pressures on you. Be co-responsible. Because that's what I think we're called on to be. All of us to do our bit. Be co-responsible for whatever profession you're in. And that includes a responsibility for yourself and for the other. Developing people of faith and hope and love. So whatever we do in our professional practices, whatever those practices are, it has to be based on an informed conscience. Where do you develop your informed conscience? And it may be that one of the things we should talk more about in the professions is where does the Catholic professional develop their professional ethics? I should maybe just say in passing here that one of the things I've established in this university is a HOPE Forum for Professional Ethics, where we gather together the professions to talk about what are the ethical issues that face all professions. Because, you know, there's some issues that face every profession. That question of accountability. One of the things you could say is all government accountability is hostile to professionalism because it drives you down a measurement route and doesn't allow you to see wider issues. It doesn't take account of discerned knowledge. It takes account only of measured knowledge. And we need to be thinking constantly of that sort of reflection as professional people. And of course we have to take account of evidence. But remember, evidence is of two kinds. You do get measured evidence, but you also have evidence that is about discernment. And that very important human attribute of a professional person to say, I know what is good. And I know what is wrong. And I know what is right. And that isn't something to be measured. It is something often to be discerned. And I think that that kind of mediation of professional thought, developed and honed through both our own professional understanding and through the teachings of the church, is very, very important. And as a professional set of professional people in the health professions, I commend to you that idea of reflecting on the teachings of the church and our professional development. And that is something about developing through looking at humanity, having a vision of humanity that is beyond the principles. It's about service and it's about ethical practices. And the middle part of that slide talking about professional ethics are to be found in the relationships that the professional person has with the person that they're being served. Professional ethics are not to be found just in codes of practice, or in books or in documents. One of the comments perhaps I ought to make as in the field of education. Education is not what you find on bits of paper. Education is found in the hearts and minds of people. That's where you find education. And that's where you find professionalism, in the hearts of people and in the relationships they have with those they serve. Not in a code of ethics, but in how you serve others. That's an important point, I think, to say of those who are engaged in health and social work, social care, education, the caring services. The ethics of these professions are found in the relationships you have with those you serve. In other words, it's the person in action. It's a reflection of the person working and serving others. And professional practice is always to improve the human condition. I mean, it would be ridiculous to think it could be anything else, that it was in some way not improving the human condition. It's a moral imperative that professional people will improve the human condition. But of course, there are ways in which we try to do that, through looking at the common good. What is right for the person and what is right for our community? These are vitally important. And that is a moral judgment that you make and that I make in our day-to-day work. What is the common good? What is the right? What's right for the individual? What's right for our community? And theologically, that is about salvation. That's essentially saying that's where we try to contribute, not only to the salvation of others, but to our own salvation. And one can look at that in a very deep way. And I think that when one does look at the common good, it is about the salvation of humanity. That's what it's essentially about. It's what lies behind it all. Health specialists, I think, are concerned with people of justice and hope. And not just about yourself. It's how do you relate to the other. And to make the very obvious point to you in fields of nursing and medicine, the pain and the joy of the self and of the other are not different. You are part of the pain and joy of other people. And I think, again, that's such an important idea, to say that we are part of community, a community of the body of Christ, working as best we can for the flourishing of humanity. There's always an empathy with the other, helping to bond communities. And perhaps that is especially strong when we're able to work in faith groups, where you can see this bonding together with a common cause. But of course there are pressures on us, and the pressures are three in particular: individualism, materialism, and economism. And these threaten our human condition. They threaten our human condition because they put undue emphasis or undue value on the self. Individualism. Concern for the self. Or they put undue value on material well-being. Or they put undue value on the place of the social services in a national economy. That it's all to do with economics. The idea of economism. And I think we've got to just fight those pervasive values of our society. These are the three huge sweeping values of our that are hostile to the values that we would want in our time: individualism, materialism, and economism. And we have to do our bit to fight against those, to be resistant to them, to say we will not allow these to develop our value base. Our values are based on other things, and our values are based on faith and hope and love. And there's nothing else. There is nothing else. All other values derive from those three thoughts: faith and hope and love. It's not complex. And don't allow it to become complex. Because these things, if they're allowed to develop, will make sure that our faith and spiritual well-being are reduced and we want those to be central to the human condition. So these are the challenges of our time. They are very significant challenges of our time. And of course, you could ask questions like, what happens when money enters professional practice? Huge ethical question. What happens when money gets into the professional thinking? And I won't try to answer it because there's another conference in that. And there's always, of course, a financial dimension, but that is not to be our main focus. And yet, of course, day by day, week by week, year by year, we are affected by financial issues. But maybe one thing that we could say just in passing, but it shouldn't be just in passing, it should be central to our thinking, that people of faith have a duty to give some priority to the poor. It's not just a good idea. It's part of our faith. It's part of our conviction. It's part of what we should give to society. Give some priority to the poor. We are called upon to do that. And don't forget the poor. Faith is integral then to professional practice, but it's always challenging. And we need to think through this particular issue in our time. The idea that there can be truth held by others that is different from truth that we would hold. And that's part of what it is, I suppose, to be educated as a professional person. To understand and appreciate that the truth of the other can be different from our own truth. But what I would say is that what is acceptable in terms of truth is not all that's legal. The legal context changed from country to country. I think I'm right in saying that if one looked internationally, for example, at beginnings of life, in this country, we are fairly liberal. In Germany, they are very conservative. The opposite is true at end-of-life experiences, with end-of-life experiences, where in this country things are controlled, have been controlled up till now at least, but in places like Germany, things are very liberal. And that, of course, raises all sorts of questions about what does a parliament do? What's the legal framework within which we operate? Because it's all very well talking about professionalism, but the legal framework and the legal context is vitally important. And it seems to me, as I look at what happens in Parliament and the legal system, all that is legal need not be acceptable. And we have to make judgments of that kind. And that raises questions of the importance of international and intercultural and interfaith dialogues. The importance of trying to understand what certain countries and societies are doing. It's very, very important. And of course, we talk much about change in the world. And I just want to say, of course, that there are many things in the world that don't change. I think that the one thing that doesn't change is, particularly I see it in schools, children need to love and be loved. That doesn't change. Technologies change, all these sorts of things change, but people need to love and be loved. Is it too much to think that that shouldn't become a human right for every child? That we should try in whatever way we can to ensure that every child, every person is loved? That's maybe the one area we still need to conquer. In the depths of our heart, look at the importance of relationships and love for flourishing in the human spirit. And I just want to finish with this quote. It's a quote, I suppose, that I use fairly frequently, and it's from Frankl's infamous book, Man's Search for Meaning. And I'll just read this out to you, because it seems to me to characterize what we should be about as professional people in the health service and in the various missions and charisms that we undertake. This is Frankl talking about what life was like in a concentration camp and how he was reflecting on what had happened to him in the concentration camp. A thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers. The truth that love is the ultimate and highest goal to which man can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. And ladies and gentlemen, you are in the business of bringing to people a greater love for each other through improved health, and through that, a love of God. Thank you for listening.